Oh, hey, didn't see you there. Don't mind me, just typing on my quirky typewriter keyboard. For anyone who doesn't know, this is a keyboard that was inspired by a typewriter, so it has actual keys, a return key, and a spot to put your iPad to type on. It's been so fun to play with, and we have one quirky keyboard to give away in our giveaway this week. If you go to mission.org/giveaway, you can enter for a chance to win, or you can just listen to me type. We also have a second product to give away this week in our giveaway. It's the Muse 2 Brain Sensing Headband. I really like their catchphrase, sitting down is just the beginning. What's really cool about this headband is if anyone has ever tried to meditate before and you're like, man, I'm just anxious about this. I can't stop thinking about the day. So many things going through my mind. Calm down, Stephanie. It's time to meditate. This headband's really nice because it actually has sensors that provide real-time feedback on your brain activity, your heart rate, your breath, and your body movements. And it helps really guide the meditation experience. So we're giving away one of these, one of the quirky keyboards. Go to mission.org/giveaway for a chance to win, and good luck.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you are listening to Mission Daily. Selected as Best of 2018 by Apple, Mission Daily is the number one podcast for accelerated learning.
Hi there, and welcome to Mission Daily. On today's episode, we have Neal Stephenson. Neal is a New York Times bestselling author who is best known for his speculative fiction books such as Fall, Cryptonomicon, and Snow Crash. Much of Neal's writing focuses around technology such as virtual reality, drones, space travel, and what the future might look like with these tools. Neal has also worked as an advisor for Blue Origin, a company funded by Jeff Bezos focused on building a road to space with reusable launch vehicles. In this episode, Chad and Neal discuss the difference between mythology and storytelling, what life in space would look like, and how Neal draws inspiration for his books.
Today's guest is Neal Stephenson. Neal, you don't need any introduction. Our audience knows about you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on your program.
Definitely. So you're calling us from LA. You mentioned that you're out there traveling a little bit. You're getting ready for the book tour. The new book, Fall, recently came out. So could you tell us a little bit about what that book is? And you're speaking to an audience where cryonics is a typical topic of conversation on a weekend night.
Okay, well, you know, I'll say it's an exploration of what could go right and wrong with attempts to extend our lives into the digital domain. So it uses some characters from a previous novel of mine called Reamed, but it's not really a sequel particularly. It concerns a wealthy individual who suddenly, unexpectedly passes away. It turns out a while back he signed a will saying that if he passed away, he was supposed to be preserved and hopefully brought back to life. His family members and friends, then this kind of falls into their lap all of a sudden, and they have to figure out what to do. He ends up getting digitally scanned, and later get sort of uploaded, and is the first person to be so uploaded. And then it's this, the story kind of takes off from there, I guess.
Yeah. And the he that you mentioned is Richard. His nickname's Dodge, and he's a tech billionaire. So this is the first, I guess, segue and question that I've really wanted to ask you for a while, which is, you know, tech billionaires, they show up periodically in your work. What's the reason for that? Do you view these characters as fascinating? Were you inspired after spending so much time around them or working with them? What's the reason for including them as characters?
So it's the reality of the world we're living in today, that there's, you know, like surprisingly large number of these individuals who have amassed a huge amount of money, and they are fixtures in the sort of tech business world. We read about them all the time, and they have a great deal of freedom of action, right? I mean, you take, say, Elon Musk, you know, if he gets interested in something, he is able to dive into it and pursue it with a huge amount of resources at his disposal. So I feel like it's that is how things are right now. So to begin with, I'm not like stretching reality or creating a situation that's plastic in any way. And it, from a storytelling point of view, it's a convenient way to set up interesting situations. You know, when you get somebody who's got that much freedom of action, then whatever they're interested in, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, they're able to sort of execute on it.
As a writer, does that give you more flexibility to be creative with the character? And does it give you more options for, say, decision trees or possible storylines?
I think it just gives more options for how that character exes their good or bad or neutral characteristics, right?
So
Most people operate in a world of constraints as to, I mean, they may have interesting ideas, they may have passions or hobbies or beliefs that are very important to them, but there's only so much that a normal person can really do, that they've got to pay the mortgage and, you know, put the kids through school and all of that stuff. In the case of characters like this, they can pretty much express whatever it is they're interested in.
Sure. And when you're writing a book like this that that tackles pretty serious topics, is there any inspiration from the past? So was was Dante's Inferno an inspiration, or are there any basically books that really gave you the nudge you needed to start Fall and finish Fall?
Yeah, I mean, and some of them are called out directly. So the Greek myths, and particularly Dolaire's book of Greek myth, which is a children's story, that's a very popular illustrated version of the Greek myth. Milton's Paradise Lost, the Bible, Lord of the Rings. It might help to explain that in the book, kind of what happens is that people come back into existence in a new universe that's getting built as they occupy. They're kind of making it, but they don't really have clear memories of the life that they lived before. And so what tends to happen is they recapitulate a lot of the myths and religious ideas that were kind of ingrained into their brains when they were alive, whether that be a class of religion like the Bible or a mythology or pop culture, mythology like Lord of the Rings.
Neil, when you're thinking about topics like religion or myth, these are topics and words that mean really different and radically different things to different people, depending on who you ask. So when we take a word like mythology, let's start with that. How do you define mythology, and then how do you approach mythology in your own work?
Well, it's any body of stories. Really, it's not authored by any one person. You know, it's folklore, and typically it is an attempt by people to explain why the world is the way it is, how it came into being, how to explain why things aren't perfect. You know, the problem of evil, to explain kind of who's in charge, what are the powers that be. So, of course, there's mythologies all over the world. I've sort of drawn on a couple of them in this book, I think, are seeking to fulfill the same psychological need that people have to feel like someone's in charge, to understand mysterious natural phenomena, to understand why there's good and evil in the world, and what happens to a sense of divine justice, what should happen to evildoers, in the afterlife or what have you.
Do you think that there are enough serious mythological thought experiments or stories that exist right now? Like, are there enough stories or tragedies or plays for our culture to be refreshed and to survive? Or are we going through a period where there's like maybe a lack of good mythologies, or there's a lack of mythologies that are going to last for a long period of time going forward? Would you agree with that? Or do you think that we're going through a period where...
It feels to me like there's a lot of them.
Do you think any of them will last a long time?
Well, I mean, which reboot of Spider-Man are we on at the moment? Yeah, how many reboots of Spider-Man? Like when I was a kid, I can remember I had an album, an LP, that was a radio play about Spider-Man. And it had Doc Octopus, it had Doctor Strange, all the same characters. You know, it was, I would listen to it on my dad's stereo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's totally believable that 1,000 years now, Spider-Man will still be a long-running character. You know, we'll get rebooted in a few years for a new generation of viewers or whatever they have 1,000 years from now.
Sure. So one of our investors, kind of like a mentor to me, he's really fond of talking about how mythologies are what they're basically stories we tell that are useful, but they're rarely true. Whereas a religion is something that we tell that is can be really useful. How do you define religion, and are there any maybe religious movements that you're excited about, or do you think that religion is evolving now in our current culture?
Well, I think I don't think there's really a hard line that you can draw between religion and mythology. So like when Christianity was getting started, the dominant religion was, you know, in that area was the Roman pantheon, Jupiter and Minerva and all of those. And at the time, that was totally a religion. Later on, as people stopped practicing that, it got sort of downgraded or reclassified as a mythology. A mythology is just a religion that has been, that's no longer being practiced.
Authentically or something.
Yeah, but that people keep retelling the stories because they're good stories.
Gotcha.
What was the second half of the question?
Yeah, the second half of the question is really, do you see new religions emerging, or do you see existing religions going through reformations, or do you think that religious innovations are pretty stagnant at the moment?
Well, that's an interesting question, right? I mean, I think that, you know, so like Mormonism is a relatively recent new religion that came along and you know, got started in the East Coast, but the people who followed that religion all sort of went to Utah and set up a new place there, and that sense of being separate from the rest of the world is, I think, probably was key to enabling them to that all work. I'm curious as to whether you could still pull that off in the internet era when everything's so networked and anyone would have do Google searches or what have you to get different perspectives on things.
Right.
On the other hand, we're seeing that social media is pretty good at creating bubbles.
Sure.
The only input from the people who agree with you. So it's an interesting question.
Yeah. Do those, let's just for argument's sake, maybe call those bubbles or pockets, islands that exist on the internet. Do you see positions maybe where these islands are sufficiently isolated, but also offer maybe like voluntary access to the mainland or something? Because I feel like if we're going to have an internet where new things are allowed to emerge, there's going to have to be spaces and islands for experimentation. Do you think that we have enough of these on the internet right now? Are we allowed to be weird enough online, or do you think that the internet isn't weird enough yet?
To have a civilization at all, you've got to be able to agree on what's real.
Yes.
And that's so obvious and fundamental that we kind of overlooked it for a long time. We didn't realize it was there. That's been taken away. And so now you can go join an island, live in a bubble that has its own opinions as to what reality is. And when that happens, it becomes impossible for kind of functions of civil society to keep on operating. You know, it's a serious problem for us right now. I'm not seeing a lot of headway being made towards fixing that problem.
I definitely agree. I don't think that there are nearly enough exit points maybe from bubbles and islands online into the real world where you can come together with others and agree on what's real, basically. And I think this brings us to an interesting subject, which is whose role is it to start solving this? And, you know, is it the role of corporations to create some type of artificial adversity in the real world? I know people like General Stanley McChrystal have advocated for, you know, 2 years of nonviolent military service, things like that. What does the answer look like? And obviously, it'll be multifaceted. But what do you think that answer looks like?
I just think that we have humans in the loop of social media, and it's not a answer that social media companies like to hear, because their whole business model and the secret to their being so valuable is doing everything algorithmically and not having to have humans in the loop. You know, as long as you keep humans out of the loop, you can scale these things really big and really fast. You know, algorithms can be gamed really easily, and ultimately to address these kinds of problems, you've got to have basically human editors exercising some discretion and making some judgments.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely agree. What's the role for sci-fi authors to kind of maybe coax a more optimistic version of the future into existence? Do you view that that's something that they should be focused on? Or do you think that sci-fi authors should just be having more fun with their work and taking more risks? What's your thought process like there?
Well, I was part of a project a few years ago called Hieroglyph, which was all about trying to put optimizations up on the page as sort of pole stars or symbols that builders could work towards in the name of creating optimistic new projects in the future. So we came out with an anthology built around that theme. And again, I think what I was missing at the time was this element of that it's all founded upon having a kind of a functioning civil society in which people agree on facts. So while we were writing about optimistic visions, that sand was being kind of washed away from beneath our foundation. Now, I think what needs to happen is some kind of solution to that problem. And so far, I'm not seeing a way forward on that front.
Right. If we had to try to pinpoint or speculate as to what the challenges are, the first thing that comes to my mind is that I'm a big proponent of McLuhan's idea that we're still basically suffering for a lot of the trade-offs of print technology. So we still think very linearly to the point where it might really be inhibiting us from doing great work in the real world. Do you think McLuhan was onto something there? And do you think that we're still living in a print-based world? And is this a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, I certainly think we're living in a story-based world. I think that we're kind of almost hardwired to process things through the lens of stories, which are linear narratives. And I think that's a thing that we go back probably to the early evolution of, you know, what makes humans different from other primates. Like, I think if you have the ability to take some experience and reduce it to a story, and then you can tell that story around the campfire, you can learn, the people listening to that story can learn something important without having to go experience it themselves.
Right.
So if I'm living in the Rift Valley a couple million years ago and I get chased by some hyenas and have to climb a tree, I can tell that story to family around the campfire later, and by visualizing that in their minds and experiencing the same terror that I experienced, they know to avoid that kind of danger without having to personally go through that experience.
Oh yeah, that ability to transmit programs and have them be stored very effortlessly on, you know, a human neural network is so important to our survival. Is there a time period where you see that? Do you see that changing in the new future with technologies like Neuralink and with some of the technologies that you speculate about and bring up in fall? How close are we to a lot of these technologies, and how close are we to being able to maybe speed up the acquisition of learning through stories and narratives?
Well, kind of what I'm doing in fall is asking that question as opposed to answering it. So if that's the topic you're interested in, I think there'll be a lot of food for thought in fall, because we have both points of view kind of represented by different people. We end up with two powerful figures in the afterlife, kind of going about it in a ad hoc, disorganized way and recapitulating a lot of the good and bad features of the world that we all came from. And then there's another his sort of adversary is someone who specifically doesn't want that. His plan is to kind of make the afterlife fundamentally better and different and re-architect the way the brain works so that it can sort of link together in a mesh with other brains and communicate in a non-verbal, non-linear fashion. And so I don't like to try to deliver pat fixed answers to big complicated questions like that, but I sure do like to, you know, to ask those questions and try to provide some food for thought.
Is it exciting for you knowing that after a new book like this gets published, that thousands of the smartest people in the world are going to be running that thought experiment themselves? Is that like, does that provide a thrill for you?
It'd be a little presumptuous to expect that.
Well, not expect it, but it is something that happens. Like, so for people that don't know, like when a new book of yours comes out in Silicon Valley, it's like not everybody, but quite a few people kind of like take a holiday and read it right away to just, yeah, talk about it and think about it. So sorry, go ahead.
Oh no. As with any book, I put it out there not knowing what's going to happen. I hope that people will enjoy it, find it interesting. A lot of what people seem to expect and want from books is something that combines a good story with some interesting ideas. And I certainly think there's plenty of both in fall, but all I can do is put it out there and wait and see what happens.
I love it. So writing a book is a really lonely task for some people. Other authors love it, or they oscillate between loving it and hating it. What's that process like for you? And the story and the example we just mentioned, how does that play into it? I'm looking for ideas and maybe stories that you have about what the craft of writing means to you, or do you view it as just a trade? Yeah, do you view it as a trade or as a kind of like a higher art?
A trade.
Yeah,
I think trying to conceive of it as fine art is, I don't think it's wrong, but I do think there's two general styles of fiction writers, and there's a group that is basically practicing a trade in making pop culture, and I'm one of those. And there's a group that for whom it's kind of like in the same category as a ballet or an oboe concerto. You know, it's a fine art, and there's nothing wrong with either of those of you, but you sort of have to be clear about which one you are.
Sure.
So I find that if I try to think of it as an oboe concerto, it just creates a high degree of self-consciousness and leads to all kinds of anxiety about whether it's all being artful enough, you know. And
right.
In my experience, writing has a lot more in common with something like making cabinets or playing soccer. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things where if you do it a lot, you get good at it and you kind of know, you have a sort of confidence. You know, if you've been a cabinet maker for 30 years and someone asks you to make a chest of drawers, you're like, okay, I got this.
Right.
It might look like you're doing really difficult operations from the point of view of someone who's never made a cabinet before. But if you've learned that skill, you know, that trade, it's not easy, but it's something that you know how to do.
When you're thinking and approaching writing like a trade, are there a lot of guidelines that you like to follow, or do you just like to keep your writing processes private because you know they work for you and that's what works? Or do you like to put them out there and get feedback and things like that? Or do you view this process as something that's like private and more creative should just shut up and do it instead of talking about it?
Well, I don't presume to tell others what they should do.
Sure, sure.
My way is to, I work alone. I don't solicit feedback until something's done. And then I'm basically getting feedback from a very small number of people. And the process can be a little different for every book. I tend to kind of reinvent the process a little bit to suit the needs of a particular book. Like in the case of Fall, for example, there was almost no research because it's all just complete, just making stuff up and writing it down. And so there was no need to keep track of a lot of notes and a lot of information about the project. You know, it was just sit down and try to tell story every day.
Sure. And when it comes to doing work that's outside of writing, I know recently you've talked a little bit about being the chief futurist of Magic Leap. And then if we take it back even further, I think you were the first team member at Blue Origin. Could you talk maybe about how you got into those positions? Because I think from the outside, there are people that glance at those jobs and think, wow, that's incredible. However, I think the work you did to get those jobs, you've probably been doing it for decades, right? So how did you go about getting that, you know, that first opportunity at Blue Origin? I don't want to say first opportunity, but like a pretty rare opportunity.
No, I got you. Well, part of it is just full background. So I grew up in a science and engineering family. I grew up in a small college town in Iowa that is, it's just completely devoted to science and technology. And so that was the oxygen I breathed until I was about 20 years old. And I wasn't aware that it was unusual. So I think I just picked up a kind of science and engineering mentality.
Right.
And then I studied technical subjects when I was in college. And once my writing career got started, I found that I had to do something of a more practical nature every day for basically like the ideal day is to get up, spend 2 hours writing and spend the rest of the day working on something unrelated. And I did some construction work on a project, an inn that a friend of mine was building, and I would program. I had a Macintosh, one of the original toaster Macintoshes, and I would write code on that thing. You know, I have a kind of jack of all trades, master of none sort of background. And what happened with Blue Origin was that I had made Jeff's acquaintance in a random way. And he was aware that I was a space geek from way back. And he had been thinking about starting a space company his whole life, basically. And so I kind of raised, just in a friendly conversation, I just raised the hypothetical question, what's stopping you from maybe not launching a full-fledged effort, but you could put together a forerunner group or a pathfinding group that would,
right,
you know, do some checking out some options and investigating some possible ways of doing it. And shortly thereafter, that came into existence, and I started trying to be helpful in that.
As a kid, did you ever think that private companies would be doing so much? Or after reading a lot of sci-fi, did you think that that was just an inevitability?
There's plenty of both in science fiction, right? So I think it seemed out of reach until comparatively recently that, I mean, none of the private space companies, I think, could have gotten anywhere without big governments having spent trillions of dollars laying the groundwork. And so they are all kind of building on a knowledge base that it comes out of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. But I think that there's clearly a generation of people in their 50s and their 40s, their 60s, who grew up with expectation that space exploration would have, at this point, would be much, much, much farther along than it actually is. And so when you get to that point, you look around, you're frustrated, you don't have your Mars colony, you don't have your space station, but you've got a lot of resources that are at your disposal, then it makes sense to try to just go for it, see what you can accomplish with a private company.
Sure. And with some recent announcements from NASA, and SpaceX has hit some milestones, and space is becoming, again, a frontier that a lot of people and a lot of Americans are looking to. Do you think that there is sufficient interest to get a permanent base on the moon, say in, by 2030, let's say? Or do you think that we're maybe on track to a moon base in the next decade? Or do you think that the second we assign a date to it, it decreases the probability that it'll happen?
It depends a lot on what your definition of a base is.
Yeah, good point.
Space in general is dangerous because of cosmic radiation and solar flares. So if you're going to make anything permanent where people are going to stay for a long time that's outside of the Van Allen belts, you need to shield it. And there's other issues around the fact that the soil itself is dangerous. It's toxic. It's carcinogenic, and being in less than full gravity has serious long-term health effects. So in my estimation, you don't really get to call it a permanent base until you've solved all those problems.
Sure.
You need centrifuges to simulate full gravity. You need full protection from radiation. It's a big project, and I think it could be done by 2030, but again, it's a little bit of a semantic question.
Right. And I think that culturally, too, there are a number of challenges that we have to figure out. I think the first one, the unacknowledged one that a lot of people don't want to consider, is how do we make space into something that's not just a sacrificial altar for people brave enough to go out there and explore and take those risks. I think that the first explorers, it's very, very important that we don't put them in a situation that's a sacrificial altar. How do you view, because the challenge in getting the public excited about these efforts, or really anybody, is you want to create media and news stories, but you don't want to create propaganda that makes people blind to all the risks and the dangers, right? So how do you think about creating new stories that are authentic as possible without devolving into propaganda for space?
People have a pretty good antenna for when they're being told an oversimplified kind of story. Right. And it's boring, right? I mean, this is not as good of a story. So, for example, when you look at the movie Apollo 13, they could have made Apollo 12 or Apollo 14. In a lot of ways, it would have been a similar production, but Apollo 13 was a much better story because things went wrong and people had to deal with it.
Right.
I think there's no real contradiction there.
Gotcha. And what about as a chief futurist of Magic Leap? Is there anything you can share there, or is there any maybe a story about how you met the founder and why you decided to get involved?
Well, they've been sort of pinging me for a little while, but I couldn't figure out what they were doing because they were in a particularly reclusive mode at the time, and they were out in Florida. Finally they sort of came over to my house with a sword, which got my attention, a reproduction of Orcrist, from the Lord of the Rings, from Weta, because they sort of have a very close, like, sister company relationship with Weta. So we started talking at that point, and I decided to get involved because there were opportunities there to do creative work, but part and parcel of doing creative work is solving a bunch of technical and engineering problems that are typical of brand new media. So I felt like I could actually be of some use in that capacity. I signed on as chief futurist, but I told them from the very beginning that I didn't just want to gaze at my navel and try to say profound things, but I actually wanted to build something. Where I've ended up, I have a little department in Seattle, sort of a content R&D squad, and we're working on creating some content for AR that is special to AR, not just a port of existing types of content, but something that fundamentally takes advantage of AR. So we're working on that and sort of tackling a lot of new engineering problems that naturally arise when you're trying to do something like that.
What advice do you have for original content shops or any type of story studio that wants to create things natively for Magic Leap, or maybe they're creating something that they think would be a fit for your department? What's some good advice for them, or where can they find out more at?
Well, the Magic Leap has a dev portal that has all kinds of resources for exactly those kinds of people. In my group, we created a thing called the Goat Labs Developer Samples, which is some sample code that provides some good fundamental tools like a debugger and a thing called the Dense Mesh Adapter. It takes a scan of the surroundings and converts it into the language of game engines. So most people who are doing anything like this are going to be working with a game engine. Magic Leap supports both Unity and Unreal. You learn new skills in order to take advantage of those game engines with AR. When you go into AR, you're no longer in the sort of privileged position of being able to author the world, and you can't decide where the walls are going to be, where the furniture is going to be, where the doors are going to be. Mm-hmm. You have to take what's physically there and adapt to it. And so that's really hard. I mean, I won't pretend otherwise. We're trying to make it easier with the Dense Mesh Adapter and other tools, but you've got to be ready to give up a lot of the skills that you've probably developed making games, making content for consoles, and start thinking in terms of, again, working with the geometry of the world as it's provided to you and adapting in a smart way to that.
Are there any team members or existing content creators working with Magic Leap that you think do an excellent job of this right now, or where they're creating content for AR where you feel like they're really pushing the boundaries and creating something that didn't exist before?
Yeah, so the two flagship pieces of content that shipped with the Creator Edition last year that come to mind are Tonandi, which is a musical environmental kind of application. You're hearing music from the Icelandic group Sigur Rós, and you're seeing algorithmically generated graphics around you that sort of respond to your touch. That's an amazing artistic and technical achievement.
Very cool. Neil, this has been awesome. Thanks for being really generous with your time. Two final questions here. First question here is, so whenever you're writing a book, you obviously learn a ton of different things. Is there a story or something you learned about yourself or others while you were writing Fall? Because obviously it's a struggle to get a novel like this finished and published. Did you learn anything about yourself or in the process that you want to share with everyone?
Interesting question. I've had a general mentality for a while that if I had multiple possible next books, I would pick the one that seemed the weirdest, like the most, or not weirdest, but the most risky or the most different.
Sure.
From previous books. And I guess what I'm about to learn is whether other people find that interesting, or have I gone too far this time?
How many other books or creative projects are you working on right now, roughly, if you were to estimate a range?
Well, I can only do one book at a time, so I'm pretty sure I know what is next.
Gotcha.
It's a thing that I've been sort of nursing along for a few years, and decided to get Fall and a couple of other books out before I really dove into it.
Sounds good. And final question here, is there any new hobby or project or thing that's exciting right now that you're looking forward to doing more of?
I enjoy making things. It almost doesn't matter what. You know, I've got a 3D printer, I've got a CNC router, you know, I work with CAD software and Arduinos and stuff to make various things that amuse me. Sometimes they have some legit value, sometimes it's just me screwing around, but it's all super relaxing and enjoyable for me to dive into making a physical project that works.
I love it. Neil, thanks for joining us. And for everyone out there, go grab Fall and any one of Neil's other excellent books. See you next time.
Mission.org is a media company with a daily newsletter, network of podcasts, and brand studio designed to accelerate learning. Head to mission.org to get award-winning podcasts like The Mission Daily, The Story, IT Visionaries, Education Trends, Marketing Trends, Future of Cities, and more. Mission Studios has worked with companies like Salesforce, Twilio, and Katerra to create custom media channels that drive results. Make sure to subscribe to The Mission's daily newsletter at mission.org.
Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning into this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. It helps spread the word, and I would greatly appreciate it. See you next time.